That's our context. The reason this stuff is funny is because it's way too close to true, right? I mean, how utterly absurd. How recognizably absurd. This is, by the way, quite possibly the end game of the removal of offense in culture. That's why it gets our attention. Because we kind of go, oh yeah, I can see the trajectory of the logic here, right? I can see this where we are now, kind of going there. And somebody just walked past me here when we were just playing this and said, is this a joke? It's like, yeah, thank God, you know, it's a joke. But only just barely, right? So this view of the world and of faith and culture that says we make it of our surroundings and of nothing else. There's nothing that breaks in or makes any demands. We just mold it to our setting. If our setting happens to be one of runaway political correctness, and our goal is to remove even the possibility that somebody just might be offended, then we really don't have a lot of choice about how we bring faith and culture together, except to go down the path of we're going to do it in a way that removes even the possibility of offense. This is, by the way, almost the diametric opposition of I'm right, you're wrong, everyone who doesn't believe like me should be shot, because in the end, we'll get to the end game sooner and only the believers will be left, right? You can sort of see how completely different these two views of faith and culture are. All right, we could keep going with that because it's just like, it's all low-hanging fruit. But let's keep going. We could also think about the story of God and humanity or faith and culture as having relatively little to do with one another. Basically, this is a view of faith and culture that says they're oil and water, right? They just are not companions. They really are different realms, and we shouldn't try to bring them together. It's not actually our job as believing people to engage with culture. And under this way of thinking, the understanding of history is that God is revealing God's self to humanity progressively in the story of the Bible in particular. So first by law. So if you're familiar with the Bible, sort of first with this set of rules that God gives to the people that are followers of one God rather than many, and says, keep these rules and you'll be living the way that God does. So God is revealed first by law and then by reason. And we sort of come into the whole Greco-Roman part of history, and we're going to use our way of thinking to kind of tease out who God is and what that means. And then we come to the story that we call the gospel. So Jesus kind of comes into the story and says, I'm here with a new story, and I'm going to adjust this. And then, basically, at the end, God comes and sort of shows us how everything really is. And so that's sort of the view of history that goes with this. And the reason that they fit together, because that view of history, we would find ourselves, by the way, in the portion of that view of history where the church comes into existence and starts to act this out. But the reason that those two fit together under this view of history, that faith and culture have nothing to do with one another, is because this view of faith and culture assumes that all of that revelation of God is being given to us for the shaping of our soul. And what happens at the end is that my soul is with God. My soul is redeemed. I can get away with that under this view without engaging with the world around me only if I believe that the unfolding of history is only properly understood as God doing what God needs to do to show humanity what they need to do to redeem their soul. And we end up as just like runaway dualists under this, right? What happens with my spirit has nothing to do with what happens with everything else around me, all of my embodied life. And what I'm trying to actually get right, if I'm trying to get anything right, is all inside. Never makes it to the outside. Why? Because the inside and the outside have nothing to do with one another. This is a view of faith and culture, by the way, that lends itself from a different vantage point to the privatization of belief, right? Your belief is your belief, my belief is my belief. They don't have anything to do with one another. Why? Because they never make it to the outside. It all happens on the inside. The inside has nothing to do with the outside. I don't know how many of you, when I think about this, I can't help but think about any number of songs that I grew up with in the church that perhaps unwittingly, perhaps deliberately, basically re-emphasize this idea that all I'm doing here is passing through. That I don't actually belong here. I'm actually an alien of the sort that wouldn't get involved in the culture in which they landed. I would kind of move through my culture inside a bubble. What's the bubble called? The bubble's called faith. And everything that matters happens inside it. Right? That's the downside of this idea. What happens in the culture out of this way of looking at the world is we can actually start to live as though we're saying to the culture around us, you want to make a culture of degradation and depredation? You just go right ahead. It's got nothing to do with me. That is the freight elevator, by the way, so the wall is not coming down. It's all okay. It's outside the bubble. All right. Or we can kind of end up thinking about ourselves as though, in the context of culture, as people of belief, we're sort of saying, I'm busy preparing my soul to meet God, and that has nothing to do with anything else. That is what matters to me. It kind of turns not in my backyard into my backyard is heaven, and unless you're trying to get into that backyard the way that I am, you don't have anything to do with me either. You're irrelevant. We might have proximity, we might have to do business, but at the core of my being, we don't really have anything to say to one another. Under this kind of a view, it's pretty easy to see how people can become projects, how even entire cultures can become projects for the religious, right? It kind of follows. It makes sense under this view. And it is kind of nice to think that I might be freed by my faith from having to grapple with the culture in which I live and move. It also, however, feeds quite nicely into believers becoming the exporters of Christian culture, which is sort of the short story of colonialism. We can't get into that right now. But there's a big chunk of near history that has operated out of this view of faith and culture. Dare I suggest that the exportation of democracy at gunpoint might be related to this? Anyway, another topic for another day. Another way of looking at the question of faith and culture dovetails pretty nicely with the thinking of those two things as not so much disconnected, not the oil and water picture, but rather than disconnected, they're in constant conflict because they're paradoxical. They're at profound odds with one another. So they're not irrelevant to one another. They're just at war all the time because they're a paradox. We could say it another way. We could think under this view that faith and culture are in constant conflict. We could think of the story of Christian faith and the culture around us as the short history of a promise given by God, which is basically, it'll all be all right someday, and the time when that promise is ultimately fulfilled. And what happens in between those two things, God makes his promise, it'll all be all right someday, and someday God comes and make it right. What happens in between is called history. And what history is comprised of is basically all of us who are stuck between those two points just battling it out. And if we're really lucky under this view of faith and culture, if we're really lucky, God will come back during our time and we get to see the end of the story. Otherwise, we kind of live the futility of this battle the whole way, not with necessarily any great hope except for that one, because that's our job. Our job is to bring the paradoxes head to head and duke it out. It sort of feeds the martyr complex, right? Or it can. The sort of view that says, I'm not really expecting anything truly good to happen until the end of the story, but somehow I'm supposed to keep on trying anyway. I would argue that under this view, futility and faith become connected at the hip, at least in what I would call this life, because we aren't really living for this life anyway in this view. What we're doing is we're in a conflict-laden holding pattern. We're waiting for the big guns to arrive and clean up the whole mess and to usher in all that's good and right. So it's not that hard to imagine under this view of faith and culture that it's pretty tough to see anything good anywhere in the world except in the company of those that are comrades in arms. And even there, it's more like commiseration, more like sharing war stories than it is like looking together at the world around us for what is good. Last one. We could look at the story of faith and culture as the history of God's grand deeds and humanity's response to them. What happens when we think that way is that our focus moves from thinking of our life now as sort of in between times to thinking of our life of faith and culture as being in the now, that God has given us. So rather than waiting for a now in which the thing that is called faith can flourish, under this view, we understand that now to be this one, the one that we're in. What's happening all around us becomes filled with the possible presence of God at work. And so instead of concentrating on something that God has started but not finished, or promised but not delivered, instead of being captivated by the idea of God's work before time began and after time ends, this opens up the possibility of discerning what God is up to in time. And as a result, participating with God in what God is doing now. Now, remember, I'm presupposing, is open-ended. It's now going forward. That's a little different picture of what history is and what it means than any of those other views. Like I said a little bit earlier, all of these things feed into one another, and they kind of get all blended up and messy, and I've kind of tried to tease them out a little bit for the benefit of provoking some thought this morning. But in this last view, God is always up to something good, something God-sized, something God-breathed, something that bears the marks of the character and nature of God's self. And those things are the things that are present in any culture at any time. They're there. And the world becomes filled with the evidences of the presence of God. If we were to come at the question of what is the place of faith in culture from this point of view, if I were to do that, this is one of the reasons why when I have this conversation at the car rental place, like my radar is just beeping and smoking and going off because I'm thinking, like, this is going to sound really hokey, okay? I don't know. But he's here! Like, you know? I mean, for this woman to carry in her view of the world the possibility that John 3:16, which says what? For God so loved the world that he gave his only son, that basically everybody could know this story and nobody would be limited or held back from it. For her to carry that around as part of her collective understanding of the universe at all in a post-Christian world is awesome. It's the presence of God possible, right? She's got whatever her story is, and I don't have a clue what it is, and I so wish I did. But she's got part of this story, you guys. Somewhere in Leanne's history is part of this story. Now, however it got bent out of shape, it became, in her imagination, much more likely to be a cultural offense than anything else, at least as that moment was interacted. But that's only that moment. It's in there in some way. And to me, as a person who believes that the world is filled with the possible presence of God, that's exciting. It's not the whole story, but it's a place to enter the whole story. So when I think about this crazy music video that we watched at the beginning, the lyrics, it's always hard to hear lyrics in here, and the song's not mixed in a way that's helpful. But let me just give you a couple of bits of this, because it raised the same question in a different and maybe more accessible, less theoretical way. One man's grinning from behind the net, waits till the camera's adjusted. Don't you worry about the flack you'll get. Aren't you scared of getting busted? The ball gets booted. It hits the cross beam. Up goes the banner, John 3:16. He don't worry about the critics. They toe the line. He don't worry about the cynics. They live to whine. He ain't going to change the world, but he knows who can. Banner man. Right? And we got this banner BM. I mean, I don't. Taylor's a really bright, educated guy. I don't think BM is coincidental. Anyways, primetime football in the Buffalo snow, freezing his little epidermis. That's got to be my favorite pair of lines in the whole song. That's just, anyway, you're a songwriter. You try to think of a way to say to, you know, the Christian right who's buying your records on a bad day what just happened there. Primetime football in the Buffalo snow, freezing his little epidermis, lifts that banner at the first field goal, drinks clam chowder from a thermos. He's never missed a game. He never spells it wrong. He never talks back when they tell him move along. He don't worry about the critics, they'll howl for days. He don't worry about the cynics, they navel gaze. He ain't going to change the world, but he knows who can. Banner man. Sports fans everywhere dying for a drink, but they've got to find the well first. One man's ready with a banner and a wink. Whole lot of souls are getting well-versed. Every time I see him, I smile a little more. I can't help praying for another high score. He don't worry about the critics. They'll howl for days. He don't worry about the cynics. They navel gaze. He ain't going to change the world, but he knows who can. Bannerman. And if you think about those lyrics in the context of what Taylor did in that little film, because it's a really pretty brilliant piece of work, he is not Bannerman as a character in the film. He's Everyman in the film. And what's he doing through most of the film? He's playing. And he's not just playing in his culture of origin. He's playing in every setting in which he finds himself. He is just sort of this embodiment of a joyful, hopeful story everywhere he pops up in that video. And he pops up in some pretty unlikely places. He pops up in other ethnic cultures. He pops up in a bad worship band. Didn't you love that worship band? When he turns the page mid-verse, I just about fell out of my chair the first time I saw it. That's funny, because we've all been there if we grew up in church, right? We've heard that band. We've played in that band. And Taylor's sort of trying to say, you guys, this story is everywhere, even in cheesy religion. Even in cultures that don't name this story the same way that the culture that I'm from names it. And if I'm going to be a banner man, and he is being ironic, and he's making a point, he's saying it's not really about hanging out this flag, although he is kind of cheering for the guy behind the goalpost, because he's kind of going, that's kind of funny. You know, that's kind of a joyful act of resistance, right? It's actually not an act of cultural offense, as much as it's a cultural joke. And if we could see this from that vantage point, if we could kind of go, it's not the story that's a joke, it's the billboard that's the joke. The story is about life and death. The story is about everything that matters. But the ways in which we bring the story into a culture that has categorically decided that holding up the banner is an offense is that we live the story in the culture. We gotta kind of eradicate in our thinking this idea that there's sacred culture and that there's secular culture. There's secular subculture and sacred subculture. We're in sacred subculture right now, up to our eyebrows. Right? This would be just the weirdest experience right now for any number of people if they just dropped in out of the, you know, side door, right? Because why? Because it's a subculture. Because we have all these shared assumptions, all these shared ideas. We don't all share all of them, but we've got enough of them in common to put up with this. But what happens if we try to imagine, and this is answering the question, what's it like to be Bannerman? What happens if our job is actually to try to imagine how to live the essence of this story of faith in whatever cultural setting we're in? And what if one of the best possible gateways, if you want, for that in our imagination is the ideas of things like joy and of hope and of peace and of kindness and of restoration? What if? What would happen, do you think? Sorry. My imagination. What would happen, do you think, in our culture if instead of thinking about this as something that's antagonistic, that needs a billboard that somebody would what? Be saved by? That what it needs instead is people who actually spend their lives trying to live the essence of this story in just everyday ways. Everyday ways. In the middle of whatever their frame of now is. What if that's actually the way that God kind of set this thing up? And that's actually the best possible intersection of faith and culture. Would that be a hopeful picture? I'm not going to start, you know, walking around with my sandwich board. It's just not me. I've got friends who do that, you know, or acquaintances at least. I do that now. I used to work with them, you know. Anyway, you know, people who stand on the street corner and sing worship songs. But actually, anyway. And just because I don't do that doesn't mean that there's no way for me to carry this news into the culture. And just because they do that doesn't mean that there's no place for the message to be carried that way into the culture either. I want to give you one little illustration of this, okay? Just to kind of, so we go out with a current story in our head and these ideas. This actually came to me courtesy of a guy I've never met, a Baptist minister in the United States. Somebody that if we both sat down to have coffee, it would probably take us a while to find the breadth of our common ground. But he was blogging about this story, and a guy in his community, who 80-year-old guy, who would say he's probably an agnostic on a good day, you know, not real sure. And he comes over to this pastor's office pretty much every day the guy's in, because he's in the neighborhood. And he comes in and he asks him these kind of, what he thinks are sort of hard questions about God. Like, you know, who did Adam and Eve's sons marry, right? You know, whatever. Silliness. But, well, silliness, I guess, depending on your perspective on the story. And so the guy, you know, they kind of have this kind of ongoing dialogue. And one day, this elderly gentleman came into this pastor's office and he said, what does God look like? Because he'd been reading his Bible, and he'd read this text that said that somebody saw the face of God and they were afraid. So what does God look like? And so he's actually asking a literal, concrete question about something that wasn't that. But in any event, the pastor said, he says in his blog, he said, I kind of gave him a simple answer because I realized, you know, his question wasn't really, he's not really asking those questions because he wants to change. He's actually asking those questions just to kind of test me. So I gave him sort of a fairly straightforward answer. And then he writes this. It was a day or two after his question, I saw the face of God on TV. And then in the newspaper. So the next opportunity I had, I told him I wanted him to see the face of God. I held up a newspaper article about Malala Yousafzai, sorry, that had her picture in it. Malala is the 14-year-old Muslim girl who was shot in the head by radical Taliban Muslims who are afraid of the light and truth she stands for. She believes in education for girls and women. She criticized the fundamentalist side of her religion. Her shooting has rallied most of the country behind her. She was recently moved to a hospital in England, and her survival rate looks good. The Taliban have sworn to kill her when they can. He goes on to talk about seeing an interview with her and her father. I heard an interview with her and her father, sort of an unreleased interview last week that was conducted when she was younger than she is now, 10 or 11. And listening to her talk in that interview about her determination about this, and then listening to the interviewer ask her father later, you know, right? If she stands up for this, you knew that there's every chance that she would be killed for this. Did you try to discourage her from speaking up? And he said, no, I didn't. This is what she's standing up for is right. And so we just together faced that. I mean, listening to a kid the age of my 11-year-old son talk with such ferocious determination about standing up for what is true and what is right. Just, to me, you want to, and to this guy who's writing about this, you want to see the face of God? Pay attention. The face of God, of course. God is light and truth no matter who or where that light or enlightenment and truth appears. And when it does, it always strikes fear in the hearts of those who are in the dark. Banner Woman. I'm just going to leave it there.